From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me on the show this week are Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington Correspondent at Al Monitor, and for the first time ever on our show, Alexis Simmendinger, White House Correspondent for Real Clear Politics. Welcome to the program, Alexis.
It's a delight to be here, Fred.
Good. Well, here are the issues. North Korea exploded what it said was a hydrogen bomb, prompting condemnation around the world. It was unclear whether North Korean leader Kim Jong-un wants to return to negotiations with the United States and other countries or merely create an international crisis. In the Middle East, the execution of a Shiite cleric by Saudi Arabia led to attacks on Saudi embassies in Iran and a serious rift between the Sunni countries allied with the Saudis and Shiite countries tied to Iran. In Washington, President Obama shed tears as he ordered a tightening of regulations on gun purchases, and a stock market crash in China, along with fears of a global economic slowdown in 2016, sent Wall Street and financial markets into a tailspin. North Korea. You know, every year or so, we hear from North Korea, and it's usually because of an explosion or something like this. What do you make of the whole thing, Barbara?
Oh, look, it's North Korea trying to get attention for itself. I think it has, you know, it has a bad case of Iran envy. And yeah, it does, unfortunately, in very disruptive ways. North Korea has a not-so-new leader now, Kim Jong-un. He's been around for a few years since his father died.
How old is he now?
No one is entirely sure. Somewhere in his early 30s. He has been doing a lot of controversial things domestically. He's been purging relatives and other senior officials in the North Korean regime. And so what better way to distract attention from problems at home than by causing a stir with a so-called H-bomb? However, indications are that it was not an H-bomb.
How do we know this?
Well, there are various ways in which they detect this, but it had a seismic signature that apparently was very, very similar to a test that was done back in 2013, and that was definitely not a hydrogen bomb. And just for you, Fred, I have the definition here. Okay, when you have an H-bomb, you use hydrogen, which is the lightest element, but it releases enormous energy when two of the heavy isotopes of hydrogen, deuterium and tritium, are fused together to form the element helium. Mm-hmm. That's what gives it this great explosive amount. And
now I
had
know.
Had it been an H test, an H bomb test, the explosion would have been something like 10 to 50 kilotons. And apparently was only about 6, or the explosive force of 6,000 tons of TNT. So that's my exhaustive knowledge about
okay.
the H bomb.
Well, let me follow up with one question. What does North Korea want?
You know, apart from getting attention again on the international stage, it's really, really not clear. Their economy is in poor shape, has long been in poor shape. I suppose it's regime survival. This is the way the regime thinks it's going to protect itself against South Korea, protect itself against any internal dissent, and continue on into yet another generation of Kims.
Mm-hmm. But one of the interesting things about this, Barbara, is that it turned out to also be an irritant to the Chinese, the ally of North Korea. And, you know, Fred's question, I think, is the one that is a head-scratcher, right? Why would you... If you've promised your Chinese ally that you are not going to do this, why would they do this?
Well, they are counting on the fact that China would rather see an intact North Korea that explodes nuclear devices than one that falls apart and sends millions of refugees streaming across the North Korean-Chinese border.
Well, that's been true so far.
It's mm-hmm. been true forever.
Yeah.
And as
mm-hmm.
long as that calculation remains the same, I mean, North Korea can do, you know, pretty much anything it wants, except for attack South Korea. We should make that clear.
Alexis, where does this leave leaders like President Obama and others? What can they do other than complain and condemn and attack and have a Security Council meeting at the United Nations?
Not a whole lot, although, of course, with this particular president with 12 months left, the efforts to do diplomatic outreach to other world leaders is President Obama's mm-hmm. natural fallback. The other discussion that's interesting is whether this is going to jar awake the Asia pivot that President Obama neglected.
Mm-hmm.
Or whether it would refocus attention away from the administration's focus on Iran and the
mm-hmm.
nuclear threat that Iran poses. Because I am no expert in nuclear armaments, but the accounts this week of what North Korea does possess is still significant to the rest of the world as a threat and a threat in the region. So President Obama's reaction has been very cautious. He has reached out to his allies in the region, and that being the Prime Minister of Japan, the President of South Korea, obviously talking to world leaders about it. But the rhetoric is pretty cautious. The president will be doing a lot of travel, foreign travel, this year, his final year, as we usually see with a final year of a president. And he will be visiting China. He will be visiting Japan. He will be visiting Asia. So we may see an additional focus, but your question is a good one. What could we do?
Well, there are sanctions, Fred, and, and here actually Iran is instructive because there's some legislation up on the Hill, I think in the House, that would impose Iran-like financial sanctions on the North Koreans, cut them off from the international.
I didn't know they had any finances.
Well, you know, the one thing the Bush administration did that caught North Korea's attention was it slapped an embargo on a bank in Macau, which apparently handled the finances for all of North Korea's leaders. So that got their attention. And also, I would say that even though President Obama's rhetoric has been pretty measured, Secretary of State John Kerry, basically, he came out, he addressed the State Department press corps, and he said that he had told the Chinese that it can't be business as usual with the North Koreans. So that was a little stronger than we've heard in the past.
Well, let's take a short break. We'll be right back with more Issues in the News.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Welcome back to Issues in the News on VOA. I'm Fred Barnes with Barbara Slavin and Alexis Simmendinger here on the show for the first time. We're going to turn to the issue of the Saudis and the Iranians. Alexis, let me turn to you. Obviously, this is a squabble between the Sunnis and the Shiites. It was precipitated, obviously, by the killing of the execution of this cleric, who was a Saudi citizen, as I recall. I mean, this supersedes nationalism. And then the response in Iran of sacking these embassies of the Saudis. Were we going to get to this sort of crisis anyway between the Saudis and the Iranians?
Well, what's interesting, I think, from a U.S. perspective is how popular this there's a couple things, but one of the things is how popular this is within Saudi Arabia itself and how careful the administration has been to continue to try to argue that the Saudis are the U.S. ally of longstanding. Iran is not the U.S. ally. But I also thought the event this week of seeing Iraq step in to try to become more of a moderating force or a negotiating force or a middleman is something that the administration seems to be very supportive of, that this is a regional squabble. The United States is eager to see Iraq itself try to execute some sort of moderation in discussion. But I know from, you know, covering the White House this week, boy, you know, very carefully phrased discussions about who our friends are and what we, the United States, you know, what our role is in this.
Barbara?
Well, look, this is an old story. You know, certainly since 1979, when the Iranians had their Islamic Revolution, that created all sorts of problems. Iran sees itself as a pan-Islamic power, not just a Shiite power, and it's a supporter of the downtrodden revolutionary movements, minorities that have been discriminated against in the Arab world. The Saudis, of course, leaders of mainstream Sunni Islam, and they regard Iranian activities as unacceptable meddling in quote-unquote Arab affairs. So this goes back a long time. They've broken diplomatic relations before. They did that back in the 1980s. But I think what's really, really worrisome about it now is that we've got these raging civil wars in the region, in Syria and in Yemen and to some extent still in Iraq. And if Sunni and Shia are at each other's throats, if Saudi and Iranian proxies are at each other's throats, you have no opportunity to resolve any of these conflicts.
Does this argument, this fight between the Saudis and the Iranians, help ISIS?
Absolutely, and I think that's what's most disturbing as well. These conflicts helped ISIS. Mm-hmm. The major beneficiary of the Yemen war has been ISIS and al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which is still headquartered there. And in Syria, of course, it helps ISIS. Mm-hmm. It detracts attention from the U.S. efforts to fight against mm-hmm. ISIS.
Alexis, I don't know whether you were hinting at this or not, but are the Iraqis, are they the, in trying to deal with this fight between the Iranians and the Saudis, are they the American proxies?
Well,
am I overstating it?
Well, I think because of what Barbara is suggesting about the near-term threat of the Islamic State and mm-hmm. the concern that you know, has posed in Iraq and in Syria, and the struggle between the Shia and the Sunni in Iraq has, I think, propelled Iraq into a role that is pretty untested for the new government mm-hmm. in some ways. But because the United States has been, and President Obama spoke to Abadi this week, proxy might be the right word to use about mm-hmm. that.
Look, the Saudis had just sent an ambassador back to Iraq after, 12, 13 years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The Saudis vehemently opposed the U.S. Invasion of Iraq in 2003 mm-hmm. and the decision to depose a Sunni dictator mm-hmm. And allow a process to take place whereby the Shia, who are a majority in mm-hmm. that country, were able to take power. So I'm not, it's nice to hear the Iraqis say this. The Omanis will try. Even mm-hmm. the Chinese have sent an envoy to the region to try to mm-hmm. mediate between two countries that are major oil suppliers mm-hmm. for China. But ultimately, this is going to have to be Saudi Arabia and Iran, coming to their senses and seeing that they really need each other in order to get any kind of stability in the region. And they're going to have to calculate that stability is better for them. Mm-hmm. And, we just haven't seen it. I mean, they're behaving, both of them, really poorly. I'd say the Saudis, frankly, more recklessly, because they knew very well what was going to happen when they executed this Shiite cleric. But, of course, the Iranians, in typical fashion, made it worse and shot themselves in the foot by trashing the Saudi embassy. So they're going to have to come to terms with each other, and I frankly just don't know what it's going to take.
Well, it is hard. I mean, Alexis, the Sunni-Shiite dispute has been going on for hundreds and hundreds of years, but and how does this crisis die down?
Well, it's not going to happen anytime soon, as you point out, in terms of the duration of time. It's also interesting that because of the unrest and the instability that you've described, and also recent events, that what the administration has been concerned about and should be is the more inward-looking thinking that's happening. King Salman's thinking about his country is a much more inward-looking worry about the situation surrounding Saudi Arabia, Iran, thinking very internally, and as Barbara points out, what would be the catalyst to encourage thinking, more outward thinking, or a coming together, or is the question.
You say King Salman is thinking. That's a big question, mm-hmm. frankly. I mean, the king has dementia, and the country is being run by his 30-something son, Prince Mohammed, who gave a very interesting interview, by the way, to The Economist. Highly recommend.
What did he say?
Well, the other issue is that Saudi Arabia is facing a huge economic crisis.
Yeah.
For Saudi Arabia because of the collapse in the price of oil, which mm-hmm. the Saudis are themselves responsible for in many ways since they kept pumping this
yeah.
stuff in an effort to hurt Iran, right? But especially Iran, very self-defeating. So they have to make budget cuts. Prince Mohammed says they're going to have a value-added tax by the end of this year or maybe the beginning of next. Saudis have never taxed any of their citizens. They're cutting back on subsidies for water and electricity and gasoline. So, they're facing some serious issues, which is probably another reason why they executed the sheikh, because, once again, makes them look strong. It was popular within the kingdom. And that's where I think Salman's, to the extent he is thinking, his attention is focused right now.
Okay, let's turn to President Obama and guns. It was a remarkable press conference that the president had this week. You were probably there, Alexis, and where tears came to his eyes when he talked about the people that were killed in some of these mass shootings. What surprised me was how modest his proposal was, that he, by executive order, to deal with gun purchases. It didn't, obviously wouldn't have affected any of these mass shootings, but it didn't seem to go very far. I was surprised. Obviously, he feels this issue very strongly. I don't doubt for a minute his sincerity.
Yes. I was in the East Room during the event in which the president was surrounded by victims of gun violence, their families. And it was striking, his emotional. We sometimes talk about President Obama as a Spock-like, you know, human being with very few dramatic emotions or passions. And,
or any emotions at all?
At all, yeah. Yes. And but it was genuine. Mm-hmm. I know, you know, from watching the event. And we have seen him do that before. And he did a town hall discussion about guns Thursday evening mm-hmm. on live television, on cable television. And he repeated that there is something about the tragedy in Connecticut that has seared into his mind and mm-hmm. it has brought him forward. But from the practical perspective of what you're describing, why is the president doing this? The president in his final year has pledged to make this a political issue. There are Democrats who believe this is a very good issue for them on mm-hmm. the campaign trail. He believes forthrightly that Congress should act and perhaps in the future will act to legislate tougher restrictions on guns. His actions were modest and, in fact, weren't even an executive order. They really are mm-hmm. administrative mm-hmm. directives or guidance from the Department of Justice. He didn't actually have to sign anything
really?
Or do anything.
Really?
And some of it is asking Congress for money, which is more of a political taunt or a dare, and because the mm-hmm. appropriations are resolved through the mm-hmm. the end of 2016. So a lot of this is politics, surprise, surprise, mm-hmm. and he is really saying, I'm handing this off to whomever it is who succeeds me.
Mm. What I don't understand, Barbara, I mentioned this before, is why doesn't he propose something stronger and then fight for it?
Well, you know, look, he's not going to.
He's
tried that. He's tried it, after the Sandy Hook and the school shootings
even
and
those,
so on. And Congress, you know, this Congress is not going to pass it. So why go through a futile effort to get something through Congress? I think what he did was what he felt he could actually accomplish, which was to, you know, close some of these loopholes about gun shows and internet sales and get the bureaucracy re-energized to enforce the laws that are already on the books. That's probably the best he could do.
Well, that may be the best he could do. My question, though, is he feels so strongly about this issue that he might fight for something that, and it, Democrats increasingly think gun control can be a good issue in the 2016 campaign. It hasn't been in earlier campaigns. Maybe they're right. And fight for something that would affect mass shootings, which are what really disturb people. Alexis?
Let me just add one thing mm-hmm. about this, and that is American public opinion is really quite predictable on the question of guns. And what's interesting is that while the president and the gun control advocates talk about public polling and the broad support for background checks or other elements, control on assault weapons, all of that is true. Mm. But where the bipartisan support for intervention, government intervention, legislation starts to erode is when they think about Congress actually taking this up in law, in legislation. So in other words, in theory, there is support and it shows up in the polls, but it's not there in terms of legislation. It's really an interesting catch. They don't trust Washington enough to make the right choices legislatively.
Okay, let's talk about what we felt in the United States is a stock market crash in early January, when usually January is a great month for the stock market, has been traditionally. And yet anybody who has even a small investments in stocks knows how painful this can be. Mm. And the problem is China. People have been writing about the Chinese economy and the Chinese currency and so on for years, warning that it was very fragile. And now something has happened. The Chinese really don't seem to know how to stop this fall of the value of their currency and their stock market from continuing to decline. Barbara?
Yeah, well, you know, the Chinese economy is kind of opaque, to put it mildly, and I think that's what mm-hmm. really worries people. They can't trust the figures. The Chinese say that their growth rate has slowed from about 10% to about 6.9%. Is that true? Is that meaningful?
Mm-hmm.
After the 2008-2009 crisis, the Chinese pumped a lot of money into infrastructure and so on. They built up to keep their growth rate high, to keep people employed. As a result, there's a huge amount of debt. banks have a lot of bad loans on their books. There's a lot that they really have to work through and unwind. But they can't do that when their stock market is plunging and when their currency is falling. So there's a lack of confidence, frankly, in China, clearly, in the government and its ability to manage the economy, and certainly overseas.
I get worried when a country with as big an economic impact as China does shuts down their stock market for a day or two, and they did it twice.
And then reversed when they realized that that was really hyping the anxiety level. One of the things economists keep talking about is that, as Barbara suggested, China is in a transition to trying to create more domestic consumption from being an exporter. And that is a very challenging thing to do, as you say, in an economy that is that big. And then the question is, if China starts to contract in this way, what happens around the world? And in the United States, there's a lot of debate right now because the Federal Reserve, has already begun to wind back its liquidity, its quantitative easing, and trying to slowly raise interest rates. So there's a discussion about whether the United States has enough tools in the toolbox now to counteract any of the slowing that we saw at the last quarter. Now, today, we got good news on the economy, and that is on the jobs rate. It's still 5% unemployment, pretty low. In December, 292,000 jobs were created. So, in terms of growth and unemployment, maybe the United States is strong enough to weather what we see happening in Europe and what's happening with China.
Well, it does.
Fingers crossed, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, mine certainly are. And we'll see what this does to Chinese influence around the world, because this has certainly affected an awful lot of countries. No question about that. There's not, I don't know what influence the U.S. can have on the Chinese economy, but certainly the Chinese economy has a great influence on the U.S. Barbara, what about, you talked about China being opaque, what about the political situation in China?
Yeah, you know, the Chinese government has a sort of bargain with its people. They provide no representation in terms of democratic rights, and in return they're supposed to deliver a good economy. So, you know, one wonders about the whole nature of that bargain, really. I mean, it's another reason why we've seen this precipitous drop in the stock market there. It's a lack of confidence in the leadership's ability to manage the crisis and a lack of knowledge about what the leadership is really up to. And you mentioned before, I think it will affect the ability of the Chinese leadership to exert influence around the world, to be respected around the world. You know, they just got their currency recognized as a major currency by the International Monetary Fund, and of course now it's lost all this value. So it is going to mean that they don't speak with quite as loud a voice, I think, in international affairs.
I think that's right. And there's the evidence is the outflow of capital coming very enormous sums. And we know from President Xi's visit to the United States, he definitely, in leadership, prides this idea that China is a strong economic juggernaut. Definitely.
I was in China for about 10 days on a vacation, actually, but toured all around China. And what I was struck by more than anything else are so many huge buildings, apartment buildings and so on, that are empty. The wind blows through them, and all this has kept the economy going in China, but at some point that doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, you know, I see a funny sort of parallel with the Saudis. I mean, if your popular support is built entirely on what you're able to sort of give your people, you know, and then there's an economic crisis, you know, that can cause real political issues and real political problems. And, of course, that instability is further roiling the markets in China.
Well, when is President Obama's trip to China, Alexis, scheduled?
The dates have not been set, but it'll be later on this year. And he will be a traveling president this year. You know, he's talking about visiting Vietnam and Cuba and Latin America. He'll be in Peru. So we will see him in the air a lot. Air Force One is going to get a workout.
Good. Anyway, that's all the time we have. Joining us today on the show were Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington Correspondent for Al Monitor, and Alexis Simmendinger, White House Correspondent for Real Clear Politics. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineers were Jackson Witt and Nick Ivanov. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Thanks for listening.